So this evening I'm going to talk about taking responsibility, because earlier this week I had a visit from the Gravity Center. That's over in Jinjin. As many of you know, that before I became a monk, I was a scientist, always keeping contact with my friends in science, and obviously Professor David Blair, UWA, is a good friend. And when he started his Gravity Center, he got me involved in little things here and there. And it's nice being able to contribute. And the latest thing they're doing is having a little bit of a exhibition about the different types of creation theories in the different religions. And basically, the Buddhist creation is pretty irrelevant. Because we've already said during our meditation, we let go of the past, even what happened a few moments ago. So of course we can let go of what happened a few billion years ago. Why worry and bring that into your minds, or whatever happened? And it's strange that many people just devote so much attention to what happened into such a long distant past, which no one can be really sure of, get some idea, but certainly not certainty. And as far as Buddhism is concerned, certainly there's nothing, no difficulty there with accepting science, with accepting the Big Bang Theory. And of course, many of you may have heard me say that modern science, the M theory, membrane theory, predicted not just one Big Bang, but a series of Big Bangs, a whole series of universes, one after the other after the other. This was modern science. So even universes reincarnate, just like you do. So when we say that does Buddhism believe in reincarnation, yeah, we do. And it's not just human beings, but even whole cosmic systems reincarnating one after another after another. That's really quite a cool idea. But really, so what? Does that really help? The problem is that sometimes people use the uncertainty of the past to justify their beliefs of the present moment. And their beliefs of the present moment, when you justify like a past where there is a big boss somewhere in the sky. When there's a big boss somewhere in the sky, there's always little bosses in between the big boss and you. And that creates what we know these days as religion. And the worst thing about it, it takes away your responsibility. In other words, instead of actually doing something about things, we end up spending too much time praying and hoping. Every now and again, just a little bit of prayer might be helpful, but it's not really praying for help. It's more like using the power of your own mind to affect things. And you can affect things in the world. But more than actually with the power of your mind, with the power of your wisdom, it's not so much what happens to you in life, but the way we regard it, the way we respond to it, is what I always say is our relation to things in life. And so often you see, whether it's the bushfires in Victoria, or it's just the personal tragedies of your life, I'm sometimes surprised that people don't use enough wisdom power to deal with what happens in life. For example, even this afternoon, just spent this afternoon at a funeral service for a 19-year-old. A young boy who died unexpectedly. Still don't know what the cause of death was. But I was struck by just how many people were sad at the death of a young boy, as if that something had gone wrong. In our society, we are sad because we don't expect these things to happen. And that's the big problem. The way we believe in life, it's not the way that life actually is. Sometimes we believe that a person should live to 60, 70 or 80. I don't know, how long should you live? How long is a person's lifespan? And if it's 80, I'm sure there's a couple of people here over 80. You should be dead by now. What are you doing? You're breaking the rules. The point is, there is no rules for when a person dies. And we should actually know that a person can die at any time. It's only when we have expectations which are not in line with nature, with truth, with the laws of physics, with the laws of life. Those are the sorts of times that we suffer. Some years ago, when I was in Singapore, somebody asked me this question. So, okay, now they're very busy. You know, Singapore people are very busy, even more busy than in Perth. And they said, look, I haven't got much time. Now, I want to understand about Buddhism. What's suffering? Can you please tell me? I've only got a minute. I've got an appointment. But I love challenges like that, because instead of actually just becoming really philosophical and just going into too many words, why not just, you know, get to the heart of thing? And I sort of answered, and I thought it's a beautiful description. Suffering is expecting from the world what it'll never give you. Expecting what this world can't provide. And you can see that with that sort of definition, we understand what is the cause of so much tragedy and so much tears and strife in this world. But we expect something which the world will never be able to give you anyway, which can't happen, which goes against the laws of nature. Expecting children of 19 years of age always to survive. Some people will die. There's that classic story, which I told this afternoon, which understands by realizing the laws of nature, how nature works, just how human beings work as well. Because we're part of nature. We're not sort of separate from it. We're not masters of the universe. We're part of the universe. And we belong to nature. And that's that story of the leaves in the forest. Beautiful story. A monk years ago in Thailand told me this story. Living in a forest, in a small hut made of bamboo and thatch, there was a storm, a violent storm. The winds were so fierce that trees came crashing to the ground around his hut. His hut, just with the bamboo and thatch, offered no protection from any falling tree, or even a branch, if that fell on his hut, would go straight through, injure, break bones, probably kill him. So he was awake all night, hearing these trees come crashing down around him. But fortunately, the reason he could tell this story was none hit his hut. He was safe. He went out to see the damage in the early morning. Sure enough, the first thing you look at is the branches and trees, which had just missed his hut. But what he really saw was something which gave him an understanding of the nature of life. He never looked at the trees or the branches. He started looking at the leaves on the ground. As you would expect, on a forest floor after a storm. Most of those leaves were old brown leaves, which had lived a full life on the twigs and branches. But amongst those brown leaves, there were a few yellow leaves. Amongst the yellow leaves, there were green leaves. And he even saw one or two freshly grown green leaves of that very young, pale colour, which showed him that those leaves must have only shot forth the day before. They too lay scattered on the forest floor, ripped from the tree, lying dead amongst the old brown leaves. He looked back up to see what leaves were left. Mostly green leaves were still on a tree. But even though there were some green leaves lay dead on the ground, still there were a few curly old brown leaves still clinging on, even though young green leaves had died. He realized that this is the nature of storms which pass through a forest. They take mostly the brown leaves, but a few of the other leaves as well. It's the same when death passes through our families and communities. They usually take the old ones, but not always. sometimes 19-year-olds die, leaving 80-year-olds, 90-year-olds. The old curly brown leaves are now a bit brown and curly, still clinging onto the tree. Now this is the nature of life. When we understand this, we can accept it. When we accept it, we embrace it. And we don't ask the world to be different. We don't demand it to be different. We make peace with the world, because how can you fight nature? You can only learn to be with it, to accept it, and make the best of it as we learn from life. These are just examples. Examples of even when you live in the bush, when you build your houses in the forest, like the monks and the nuns who come and teach here do, you can expect bushfires to come. And some of those bushfires you'll survive. Some will kill you. That is the nature of life. If you live in a forest, you have less chance of being mugged, raped, but certainly you have more danger of bushfires. Wherever we go in life, there are dangers. And even if you don't live in the forest, there's one of the ladies here I just remembered when I just looked at her a moment ago. She was living in one of these blocks next to King's Park. Even the city, she almost got burnt out by the bushfire. Wherever you are. So, when these things happen, we have to accept this is part of the nature of life. We are part of it. And it's not, having lived through the bushfire over in our monastery in Serpentine, so about 20 years ago, I can tell you it was 1991, it was 18 years ago, on January the 30th. And that day was the hottest day ever recorded in Western Australia. 46, 47 degrees it was, according to the metropolitan forecast. And our thermometers in the monastery, we saw 49. Hottest day of the year. Later on, 2 weeks later, there was a day which was hotter. But still that ranks as the second hottest day ever in this state, in this area. And that was before the fire came, and it got hotter afterwards. And the whole monastery, those of you who've been here a long time, know what happened. The whole monastery engulfed in flames and fire. And I was there at the time. Whole trees exploding. It was a wonder to see. It was like a bomb going off. And the noise was great. And just the whole tree exploding in one go. And there you were, in the middle of it all. And of course, you were quite prepared, as much as you could be, with your fire pumps and your overalls, fighting that fire. And actually, at the time, the fire officers were the ones who made the mistakes. We were more prepared than they were, because they panicked and told us to leave. Get out, they said. And so we had to follow their orders, even though I know now, as I knew then, but I was following orders, in a fire, you flee before or after, but not when the fire is hitting. But we followed the orders, and we went down. And I remember even being interviewed by Channel 9 or 7 or something at the time. It's actually a funny experience. Because of my training as a monk, there's no fear. It's just part of life. You just do what you can. And if you die, you die. It's amazing the training you have. You're not afraid of these things. You're at peace with life. One day you're going to die. If you die in a forest fire, then the Buddhist society doesn't have to pay for your cremation. Monks have got a very sick sense of humour. I told last Friday, I didn't think I told this last week, but I was visiting a man who had cancer. And he was telling me about how expensive his treatment was. You know, he'd spent, you know, private health cover over about $12,000, you know, having some sort of tests and these amazing robots. And when he told me this, you know, he said, well, what happened? He just found more cancers. And I said, well, you know, $12,000 is a lot of money. You know, a coffin only cost about $500. Fortunately, he got the joke and he laughed instead of kicking me out. But we're not so afraid of these things. So because you're not afraid of these things, you're peaceful throughout. And during the interview, apparently the interviewer at the time was actually quite impressed, because the first time, she told me this afterwards, first time she'd seen somebody in such a sort of a life and death situation be so cool and calm about the whole thing. She was so impressed, she rang me about a month later on and said, I can't get you out of my mind because I can't never seen anybody so peaceful after such a dangerous situation, this huge bushfire, this crown fire, you know, the whole tree, not just on the ground. And she said she wanted to do an interview with me on her new program. I said, what was that? It was actually the Hinch Report. And I didn't know what that was, but I asked the president at the time, and said, don't go on the Hinch Report, because apparently that was just looking at all sorts of scandals and everything else. So anyway, we never got on there. But anyway, the point was that you learn how just to be more at peace and accept these things. And at that time, when we evacuated, you know, you could see, just I was there when the sort of forest was on fire, and you could see from the distance just the huge flames soaring up into the sky and the explosions, because you know the eucalypt trees in such hot weather, they sort of, the oil evaporates, and that oil evaporating and mixing with the oxygen in the air is an explosive mix. So when those trees ignite, they explode. It's a bomb going off. You saw those bombs going off in your monastery. And I thought, all those hard years of work, I've lost it all, including those two bad bricks. They've disappeared as well. I lose a whole lot. And there's a wonderful thing there to also test yourself, to realize, yeah, it doesn't matter. Even if your whole life's work goes up in smoke, it was still well worth doing. If you've had a son, he only lives 19 years. It was well worth having you for those 19 years. Thank you so much, son, for being with me for that time. Even though it was such hard work building a monastery, it was worth it. And I was totally willing to let it go and allow it to be totally destroyed, and thought that when I went there the next time, I'd just start building it again. But of course, those of you know the story, that when we went back the next day, when we were allowed to go back by the police and the fire department, the monastery was still standing. Only a caravan had been destroyed, and everything else was still there. It's amazing just some of the power which monks have. Because I remember being with the chief fire officer came to inspect a couple of days later, and I had to be to take him around. I remember him looking at one of those huts and saying, Brahm, this should not be here. It shouldn't be here. Why is it here? And of course, I know why it's there. And I think you should too. Sometimes there's some power which, you know, you can have every now and again. It also reminded me of another bushfire story. I'd never seen this, but I tell this quite often. You know, when I go to do some chanting at people's houses. You know, we have all these little ceremonies in Buddhism, like chanting and stuff. But why? Does it really work? This was apparently part of a segment on a TV show which was broadcast throughout the world, networked, called The Unexplained. It's a sort of show which I would look at if I could watch the TV, because I always like weird stuff. And this was called The Unexplained. And apparently this particular program took weird, strange events which had happened and trying to find out why. And on this particular show, this segment, they were panning a hillside in California after a very, very severe bushfire. And just like in the Victorian fires, you see house after house reduced to smouldering ash, trees with nothing green left on them, people with their whole savings, their whole life reduced to rubble. And as they panned this hillside, house after house destroyed, And then they came to a house which didn't even have a soot mark on it, was standing, unscarred. And they carried on to the other side of that house. More total destruction. Above, below, to the left, to the right of that house, everything had been destroyed. So they were asking, why? Why was this house saved while everything else was destroyed? The unexplained. So they interviewed the owner. The owner was a Korean American, a person who'd migrated to the United States with nothing, who'd worked hard, saved, and built their first house. And they said, when you built the house, did you have sprinklers on the roof? No, he said. Fire shutters? No. Did you have fire pumps? No. Well, how was your house saved then? What special thing did you do which the other houses didn't do? And he said, maybe this is the reason why my house survived. He said, when my house was completed, I invited my brother over, who was a Buddhist monk, to do some chanting in my house. And he did the chanting and sprinkled all this water over my house. And once he had finished, he said, now your house is safe. So I never even got insurance. Didn't need it. There you go. If you come here, we can save you a lot of money. Who knows? Sometimes these things happen. So anyway, you can see that sometimes there is some sort of other things happen in this universe which protect you. But what you can do is you can say, well, you know, this happens in life. And all of the stuff which you accumulate, all your possessions, this is actually the lesson of those Victorian bushfires. To expect the unexpected. Never to put all of your security, you know, in houses and in your possessions. Because they can be destroyed, if not by a bushfire, by economic collapse, when you lose all your shares, and you have to sell your house, you know, to pay off your debts. Or, you know, divorce. Or some of you guys, someone finds out that in your youth you fathered a son or a daughter and you've got to pay all these payments, which means you have to sell your house. There's lots of stuff which can happen to you where you lose all this so-called security and material things. And that's why, like, religions like Buddhism, you know, keep on encouraging you. The stuff which you have, you know, your house and your possessions, please don't feel that that's, you know, your security. There's the other stuff which is even more important. You know, what I've said here is called your social and your emotional capital. And that's far more important. And you can see those communities, say in Victoria, which were devastated, the reason why they survive, the reason why they rebuild, is nothing to do with money. It's their social capital and their emotional resilience. That is what will pull anybody through any crisis in life. The social capital is our friendships, our togetherness. Whether it belong to sort of a community such as that which comes every Friday night at Nolamara, our family, our friends, our place of work or whatever. This is what we call like the social capital of life. When people meet together and develop the friendships and these social bonds, we help each other. There's an old story of fingers of a hand. If you have fingers of a hand, if one finger gets hurt, if one finger gets infected, the whole hand cannot be used. Which is why every finger has to look after each other. Little finger has to look after the big finger after the middle finger. They all have to look after each other because they know when one finger is hurt, the whole hand cannot be used. It's like a family. Like a community. We know when thousands of miles away in Victoria, When people hurt over there, we hurt over here. That's why we help, why we share. And it's that which rebuilds communities. And sometimes, in tragedies, they have the silver lining. The silver lining of just how people come and help. And how people just drop what they're doing and come and look after you. Even in our bushfire, sort of 18 years ago, it was wonderful to see, even though there was nothing destroyed, there was still sort of lots of infrastructure which was complete. There was no water for the first almost 2 days. And people would come up and help and look after and serve. Even our local hardware store came up as soon as they heard to replace the pipes. They just went out of their way to look after and help us, as we do. Even the local greengrocer, a shop in Armidale, sort of came up with a whole big bag of carrots and apples. Not for us, but for the kangaroos. Who are also part of our monastery. That's really thoughtful. Because those kangaroos had nothing to eat. Nothing at all. It was wonderful to look after. That's probably why the kangaroos are still around, because they realize, yep, you monks and you Buddhists looked after us in the hard times during the fire, so we're going to be around looking after you from here on in. Sometimes in those times of tragedy, you have this beautiful thing happens. When somebody dies, that's when you just see who your friends really are. And how many friends you have, and how many people care about you, how many people look after you. That's one of the wonderful things about life. In tragedy, you see some of the beautiful parts of life. I even remember just over in London when I was visiting my mother many years ago. She lived in a tower block. Again, I did come from a poor family. It was just owned by the local council, rented out. It's one of these places. I never seen that TV series, The Bill. But I know that many people are completely addicted to The Bill. And someone was telling me about it last Saturday. And apparently many of those episodes are in these so-called sink estates in England. That's where my mother lived. That's where I grew up. I came from a sink estate. So, yeah, you can do pretty well going to sink estates. I did well in life. But anyhow, this was supposed to be a hotbed of crime. So people said. But listen to this experience. Stay with my mother. I was going out to the local temple, a Sri Lankan temple. It was about an hour's walk away. And I liked exercise. So I decided to go and walk there to give my evening talk. So as I went down the elevator, when it reached the ground floor and the the sliding doors of the elevator parted, in front of me was standing maybe a 60-year-old woman, covered in blood. I just wondered what had happened to her. She said she'd fallen down the stairs to the basement, concrete stairs. She was terribly injured, but at least she could stand. There was no telephone there. So, took her back into the lift, and up to my mother's apartment, trailing blood. My mother, she said, I'm not very good at this. When she sees blood. But being a monk, he used to anything. We're very adaptable as monks. So I took her in. We started bathing her. My mother called the ambulance. But a wonderful thing happened. People in that so-called tower block had got to know each other. And they saw a trail of blood leading into my mother's apartment. And they followed that trail of blood to find out what had happened, and how can we help? And within a few minutes, they had so many people in my mother's apartment trying to help and look after this lady. She had her lunch on, so they took her key and turned off the gas. They called her daughter, and they did all these other little jobs for her. At that time, I realized, this is not a sink estate. This is a community. A place where in times of difficulty and trouble, people are willing to stop what they're doing and look after one another. That's a beautiful part of life. to see how people really care and why sometimes we need a tragedy to be able to see just the beauty in human beings. And to me, that is worth much more than a big house and a big car and a big bank balance. So for my whole life, instead of trying to accumulate wealth, I try to accumulate good karma, accumulate kindness and generosity and looking after people, my social capital. And that's why when I ever go traveling, very rarely take any health insurance when I go traveling. Just recently returned from Sri Lanka. Never took any health insurance there. You know why? Because there's so many doctors in Sri Lanka. And if ever I got sick, there'll be a fight about who had the right to look after me. It's quite funny, it's enjoyable. Which is wonderful to have that. And why are they doing that? Because they care about you, because I care about them. And so that's my insurance. Now look at me, I've got no money, no superannuation. Ajahn Vong, what are you going to do when you retire? You won't let me retire. I often say the older you are as a monk, the harder you have to work. I'm only sort of 57. When I get to 67, then you're really venerable. 77, wow, the wise old monk of Serpentine. 87, and wow, that's when the sort of the premier and the prime ministers will come and be asking for a blessing or advice. So I know what my future is like. No retirement for this one. So I don't need superannuation. I'm not going to be allowed to retire. Even I'm not going to probably be allowed to die either. If ever I get sick, you say, no, no, you can't die. So I've got no freedom at all. But you can understand that social capital, that kindness, that goodness, that is what's really important in life. And that's whenever there's a tragedy, please don't go looking at those papers, the Victorian tragedy. Yeah, there's a tragedy over there, the bushfire tragedy, but there's also some beautiful things happening. And we must always focus on the beautiful stuff as well. People caring for one another, looking after one another, donating to each other. And those are the ones which I really like to focus on. Again, recently in Sri Lanka, just seeing just where the tsunami hit. Tragedies, many people losing their lives, but many people having beautiful, wonderful experiences. One of the places where I visited over there, and the people taking me around said, this must be the place where that story happened. Because there's only one river down south where there are crocodiles. Man-eating crocodiles. And many people apparently have died in that river, eaten by the crocodile. But there was one man apparently would actually feed fish in that river. Just take some bread and throw it to the fish out of kindness to the animals. He said one day, as well as the fish, a crocodile came. And so he thought, crocodiles are just big fish. They must be hungry too. So he threw a few slices of bread to the crocodile. From that time on, the crocodile would come every day to get his couple of slices of bread. And he was feeding the fish, apparently, when a tsunami hit. And that was one of the worst places where the tsunami hit. And it was just outside of Gaul, if I remember correctly. And he got swept away by the power of the wave. The current was so strong, you couldn't resist it. And as he was being swept out to sea, to join the many other people who would die, he grabbed on to anything which he could find. First of all, a chair. You would think that you could hold on to these things. But the force of the current was so strong, swirling, flowing, he got parted from the chair. So the next thing he grabbed onto was a log. He could hold on to that log. And you can imagine the confusion. And it took him a few minutes to realize something very strange was happening. While everything else was floating out to sea, the log was floating towards land. And you know that story. When he got to the bank, he could climb on. And it was only then he looked at his log and found it wasn't a log. It was the crocodile. He was saved by the crocodile. He'd fed. It may have been compassion. It may have just been a crocodile's desire to get some bread tomorrow. But I don't think the crocodile thinks so much. It's probably just kindness to someone who helped him. Beautiful stories. When there's tragedies, there's also some beautiful things happen in life. And it's those beautiful things happen which are what inspires us and gives life its meaning. Amidst the darkest hours, there's always beautiful things which we can focus on. In the deepest depressions, there's always opportunities to see beauty. And it's this which inspires us and also helps us to maybe contribute to that beauty, to that sort of inspiration in difficult times. Yeah, this is what life does. We do have bushfires, we do have tsunamis, we do have earthquakes, we do have the tragedies even in Perth, but they're not so newsworthy. Just ordinary deaths, car accidents, and other tragedies of cancer which happen in our communities. These don't get publicized because they're not so newsworthy, but they happen. But when they do occur, they give us amazing opportunities to develop this compassion, to develop this service, to develop this selflessness, to understand what it's like to be a human being, and to celebrate the opportunity to care, to give, and to serve. There's an old story about generosity which comes to my mind now. It's a story from the Dalai Lama before he was very well known. This was when he was still over in Tibet. He was a famous monk. He would travel from place to place just so people could see him. It's the tradition of monks to be travelers, so don't blame me when I spend so much time in Sri Lanka or Singapore or other places. This is just tradition. So anyway, he was traveling in Tibet around the poor villages. And there was a journalist traveling with him from the United States doing one of the very early articles on His Holiness the Dalai Lama. But the journalist saw some very strange things which he couldn't really get his head around. Because there was a tradition in that place that people would line up to hand and give gifts to the Dalai Lama. Many gifts. Now remember, before the Dalai Lama left India, he lived in a palace, the Patala Palace. He was head of state, had the very best foods, nice robes, everything you could ever want. And here he was, being given gifts by some very, very poor people. And this was getting really under the skin of the journalist, making him more and more upset and angry. And apparently, the journalist was with the Dalai Lama in an extremely poor village. And there he saw a woman, an old woman. Maybe she wasn't that old, maybe only in her 40s, but in those hard subsistence villages, at 40 you look like 70 or 80 in Perth. And this poor woman, in rags, handed the Dalai Lama a gift. The gift was a skirt, a piece of woman's clothing. And at that, the journalist exploded in rage. You talk about religion and kindness and compassionate. You know, you live in a palace. You've got so many nice robes, so much. And this woman is so poor. And you're a man. You don't need a skirt. What are you doing? You should be giving her something. She shouldn't be giving you these things. No, you don't need these things. And then the Dalai Lama paused, and with this beautiful wisdom, he said, "Sir, you're right. Now, whenever you're being argued with, always tell the other person, yes, you're right, but... That's always the best way of solving any sort of argument. Said, yes, you're right, but, and this was the killer statement from the Dalai Lama, you're right, I don't need a skirt, but that woman needed to give it to me. She needed to give it to me. And there the Dalai Lama was actually revealing just how as human beings we just need to give to each other. As an expression of our love, our respect, our kindness, or whatever. It doesn't matter whether we need it. The other people need to give it to us. Ever since I understood that, when people give me things, they haven't given me a woman's skirt, but they have given me a comb. So what do? You get a comb. Thank you very much. You receive it because they need to give it to you. And then you go and give it to somebody else. What was it? It's one of the stories many, many years ago. I'm just looking whether she's here this evening. I can't see her. But this woman who's a regular over here knitted me a pair of socks. I don't wear socks. Actually, the last year, I think, when I went over to, I think, Japan in the winter, I wore some socks. Maybe I'm getting old now. But usually I don't wear socks, even in the cold weather. Even when I was in England, visiting our monasteries over there, even though it was snow, I still didn't wear socks. I've got really good circulation in my feet, so I don't really feel the cold. Anyway, I don't wear socks, but she made some for me, especially just for you, on a Friday afternoon before the talk. So I said, thank you so much. And I put them on, even though it made my feet sweat. But I did more than just put them on. When I was giving the talk, like I'm giving now, I started fidgeting. And as I was fidgeting, those people who are on my right can see, I put my foot out and I wiggled it to draw her attention. And she was sitting to my right over there. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw her. She noticed. And she turned around in the middle of my talk to a friend and said, he's wearing my socks! He's wearing my socks! I made her happy by putting her socks on. Why not? Even if I was uncomfortable. I took them off afterwards and gave them to somebody else. But it was needed to show that beautiful care and generosity towards one another. You can see how beautiful spiritual that is, to allow people to care for you. And even if you don't need it, accept it and say thank you very much. You can always give it to somebody else. You pass it on, and that way your gift never loses its value. I'm not just talking about socks. The gift wasn't important. The care which went into it, she knitted it herself. That was the most important point. And so that we can say, whenever there's a tragedy, it gives us the opportunity to care, to give, to help, to serve. Because sometimes it's very difficult in life to find people to care about. Because everybody is so damn self-sufficient. You don't need anything, do you? I can do it myself, thank you very much. No. Even if you can do it better yourself, let a person help you. That's why I say, I don't know if they do it these days, but when I was growing up, you always had Boy Scouts, and they would always help, you know, old women across the road. And at that time I used to say, if ever a Boy Scout comes to help you across the road, please say, oh, thank you very much, and let them help you across the road. Even if you don't want to go. Just they needed to help you. Say, oh, thank you very much, young man or young girl, whatever. And when they've just gone around the corner, you can cross back over again by yourself. The most important thing is you allow them to care. Because every time you allow people to care, you're actually encouraging that beautiful caring in society. So if anybody ever says, I can do that for you, let them, even if you can do it better yourself. It doesn't really matter sort of what it is, because we want to be able to encourage that beautiful compassion and caring in life. So this is actually what happens whenever there are tragedies. It can have a beautiful part to it, the opportunity for us to care and share, and also the opportunity to realize that this is the wealth of a nation. The wealth of the nation is not in bricks and mortar, because that gets destroyed. But what really survives, they haven't lost everything in Victoria. They haven't lost much at all. They've lost their house, their possessions, maybe some relations, but they haven't lost their heart. They haven't lost their goodness. They haven't lost their spirituality, sense of community, of being part of things. However, people focus on things all the time. You know, on your house, your mortgage. Sometimes the only reason we focus on these things is because they just take up so much of our time. You work many hours to build your house, but you also work many hours to build your family, to build your friends, to build your own sort of friendliness towards yourself, your own sense of sort of integrity and self-respect and softness towards yourself. That takes a lot of time to build as well. But sometimes we always focus on sort of things, material things. And this is what happens when we focus over much on material things. When these things disappear, which they have to, it's the nature of life, it's the law of nature, fires, deaths, whatever. If we focus on these things, that when they do disappear, we'd always get frustrated, disappointed, and sometimes even angry. Why did these fires happen? We get all these stupid responses, knee-jerk responses, let's just burn off all the forests, relocate people, do this and do that. So, looking in the newspaper today, all these arguments about should we do controlled burn-offs or not controlled burn-offs. I know in our monastery we did controlled burn-offs, that never saved our monastery. That sort of destroyed all the trees anyway. So all these sort of arguments, backwards and forwards, that's not, I think, the most important thing which comes out of the tragedy of a bushfire, of a death, of a tsunami, of an earthquake. The most important lesson is not so much how to preserve our houses, not even how to preserve our lives, but how to preserve our sense of community and care, and working together, and helping one another, and learning how to embrace these uncertainties of life. Expect them. Doesn't matter how many preparations you do, fires will always destroy. Doesn't matter how many early warning systems, there'll be still tsunamis. Doesn't matter how much you meditate and eat brown rice and exercise, you'll still get fat. It happens, believe me, I know from personal experience. And you still die. So this is our life. So we look at something which is more stable, more important, more valuable than all of these material things. And this is what I'll be talking about tonight. Sometimes, build a house, but it's not a home. Now, a home is where you have kindness and care in that place. No joy in that place. So it'd be wonderful if instead of just thinking about just the next plan off the most modern architect, it's actually the way that thing is. Look, just at the moment, just I'm really working hard finishing off our retreat center. And you know, there's always problems when you come to the end of a big project like that. But I've always made sure that we're always kind. Because for me, it really doesn't matter. I mean, when you go down there, there's more than two bad bricks, I assure you, when you go down to that place. But there's many beautiful bricks as well. But the most important thing is not the fact it may look beautiful, but how it was built. Because I remember just some years ago going visiting another Buddhist center, and they just built something, and they said, never again are we going to do any more building. the amount of arguments and tension, and who want to do it this way and that way. It was just a nightmare. Never again. When I heard that, it's, what are you doing? Is this a Buddhist building or not? Is it a building for Buddhists or a Buddhist for building? What is the priority here? And for me, it's always not what you actually achieve in terms of the results. It's always the process is more important, how it's achieved. And to me, the success of this project, you won't see it when you go to visit the place. All you'll see is just the bricks and the mortar and whatever else is there. But you haven't seen just the number of people who've served and helped. And the fact there has been problems, but we don't get angry. We don't shout at the builder when they make a mistake. We talk to them. Sometimes people have said, I'm just too soft. But if I was more fierce, then we might get a higher standard retreat center. But I said, no, if I was more fierce, we'd never get any money to build anything at all. So because I'm kind and soft, at least we get a retreat center. It may not be the most perfect. If you had stood your ground and shouted, maybe you might have got it more perfect to look at, but not more perfect to live in. To me, the process is more important than the results. The material things which you get at the end are not as important as how you achieved that, how you got there. And to me, it's always about the process. Whether you live long or live short, 19 years or 91 years, doesn't matter the length of time. It's the process. How have you lived those 19 years? How have you lived those 91 years? It's the quality of those years, not the length. The length, the price, the size, that's material stuff. The quality, that's more important. It doesn't matter about how much money you have. It's how much you're enjoying that. It's the quality of that. And how you got that in the first place? You may be poor, still be happy, just like me. You don't have to be a millionaire to have a smile on your face. But how you got that million, or how you didn't get that million, or how you got that $1, I haven't got $1 actually, that's more important, the whole process of things. So the bushfires, deaths, tsunamis, economic crisis, whatever it is, that's not important. What's really important is the whole process. How are we dealing with this? Forget the buildings. Remember the people. There has been deaths, tragedies and loss. But there's amazing opportunities. You all know the Australian bush grows from fires. It regenerates the bush. Just look at any of you go down to Serpentine Monastery. Sometimes you wouldn't believe the sort of 19 years, what was it? 18 years ago, there was a huge bushfire down there. I just remember taking photographs straight after the fire, and 12 months later, you couldn't believe there was a fire there, and there was not any green thing standing at all. The bush regenerates. So do human beings. We grow from tragedy. When we lose our loved ones, when we lose our homes, when we lose our money, it's not all loss. Something else grows in its place. Humanity, care, the spiritual qualities, they grow like the phoenix out of the ashes. Life goes on, and people have been through those tragedies. They sure they'll say, never again. But they also say, what a wonderful experience that was. Tough, hard to bear at the time, but you grew so much. Certainly, having been through that bushfire in Serpentine 18 years ago, it was because of that more than anything that we became part of the local community. We had to work together. It was there that we really got to know our local council and shire and our neighbours and everybody else who came to our assistance. That's when we became part of our locality. And that's when in tragedy, we become part of our community. After that experience with that lady who'd fallen down the stairs. From that time on, I was a part of that tower block. My mother said, people kept talking about you and asking, when's he coming back? Before that time, if they saw me, people would look at the ground, look at the other way. Who is this guy in a woman's clothes? Because that's what they thought it was. They didn't know what a monk was. But after that little experience, you became part of things, accepted, part of that little village which lived in a 20-story block. In tragedy, this is where we build our community, our friendships, our care. It's not all ashes. There's some beautiful flowers grow out of those ashes. And that's what we're talking about this evening. So, when we talk about life, please never expect more than this life can give. There will be difficulties and tragedies and disappointments in life, many of them. You know that. You've had many yourself. Please put them in perspective. Know they're going to happen. And know that when they do, there's much you can do. You aren't helpless in face of the fire or the tsunami. It's not just an act of God, which you just have to submit to. There's much you can do. Not with your hands, but with your heart. These are places where spirituality can really grow and can help you. We call it karma. It doesn't matter what you're faced with. It's what you're doing with it. That's what's the most important thing in life. You've lost a son. You've lost a house. You've lost a boyfriend. What are you doing about that? It's amazing what you can do. And you've found in the most dirtiest of soils, the most beautiful flowers can grow. That's why people come to places like this. Why spirituality will always be more important than economics. Because it teaches something which is more resilient than even the hardest of concrete. The heart, the kindness, the love. Things which fire can never destroy. Things which can never swamp. Things which are always going to be there for you, which grow and grow and grow. The beautiful part of life. Thank you for listening. Okay, I never expected to talk on that subject, but these things just come out. So, hope you enjoyed it anyway. So, President, questions, yeah. Anyone got any questions about anything whatsoever? Yes, go on. Sword of what? Oh, sort of 57. Well, I'm not counting my previous lives. That was a quick answer. I don't know what I meant when I said that, but that's a decent answer. Because how old are you? Sometimes I look at some of your kids, and maybe only sort of 10 or 11 years of age, but you look at them, they're older than that. They've come from many, many places into this life. This is not their first life. So how old are you really? If you count your previous existences, you may be thousands of years old, 100,000 years old. That's cool, yeah, you're doing pretty good for 100,000.